Are You Just Watching is supported by our dearly loved listeners. Special thanks to Tim Martin, Richard French, and Stephen Brown II for their monthly support. To help support Are You Just Watching, please go to patreon.com/areyoujustwatching. Show notes for this episode can be found at areyoujustwatching.com/64. Are You Just Watching? Episode 64, Doctor Strange. Welcome to the podcast that shares critical thinking for an entertained Christian. I'm Eve Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And this was an interesting movie.
It was what you would expect from Marvel fare with a few interesting twists in there.
Yeah. This one, it was unexpected. I kind of went in completely blind, not knowing a whole lot about the movie other than a few movie trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it hugely entertaining and amazingly full of stuff that made me think of scripture, believe it or not, as I was watching the movie.
Yeah. I wish I'd had the opportunity to see the movie one or two more times as we were going through and doing our show notes and everything. Or our movie notes, not our show notes. I was thinking, man, I wish I could remember that quote, or what was it that Catechus was saying? But it is loaded.
Yes, very.
Absolutely
and
loaded.
I would start writing down a quote, and it would already be like three lines into it, and I'd go, and I could only remember the end.
So. Yeah, exactly. You're paraphrasing the quotes as you write them.
The movie score is by our good old friend Michael Giacchino. I don't know how many movie scores we have had from him.
Feels like he's done half of them.
Half
the ones we've reviewed.
Yes, it's amazing. He's prolific. We'll play a little bit of the music here for you. About the score, I won't say it's weird. It kind of matches how weird the movie is.
He does in every other film we've seen with him. Mm-hmm. He's done a really good job of matching the feeling of the music to the feeling that the director is portraying in the film. Mm-hmm. And I think this is no exception. Although it was just, I wonder, does Disney have an option on this guy? Because he's done all the Disney films, hasn't he?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah, I think that's what we had noticed before, because he did, I think it was Tomorrowland, and he did Inside Out.
Yep.
I don't remember what other movies. I know those two for sure, but it does seem like almost all the Disney movies that we've looked at that, mm-hmm. that he was the composer for.
They certainly have a gold mine on their hands.
Yeah. I do like his music, though I will tell you that I'm beginning to just like with John Williams, I'm beginning to hear, you know, the Giacchino isms to his soundtrack. You know, it's like you can almost always tell a John Williams when you listen to it. They all kind of have something in common, and I'm starting mm-hmm. to find those in the Giacchino scores as well.
He's got a style that bleeds through the music.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The director of this is Scott Derrickson. Do you know what else he's directed? Because the name is not familiar to me.
I don't, but I should be able to pull it up right here. Let's see. Doctor Strange, The Exorcism, Deliver Us from Evil.
See a theme here?
The Devil's Not Sinister, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, Hellraiser Inferno.
Well, we saw some articles that seem to imply that this man is a Christian.
Oh, they came out and stated it outright.
Yeah. we could not find any actual confirmation of that, but lots of people out there are saying that he's a Christian. And judging by his movies, that's kind of an interesting twist.
Well, you know, what was this movie? The Conjuring. The people who make, I haven't seen either one. It's they're on my list of movies to watch eventually. But the people who make The Conjuring are both very strong Christians.
Mm.
And they, I heard a very brief snippet of an interview with them where they try to use the movie to depict the grace of God or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing is all very spiritual. I mean, a lot of the ones that you just named off were movies that have some kind of a spiritual aspect to them, maybe not necessarily a good Christian spiritual aspect. But that's kind of where this movie kind of heads to, is that it's all about a spiritual warfare that the average person doesn't even notice is going on around them.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe just the Christians are a little more willing to delve into that space for stories.
I don't see why that wouldn't be the case, since Christians, by definition, have to believe in eternal soul and you know, the battle against Satan and his minions.
Yeah, definitely. Now, this movie was fairly clean. I can't remember. There may have been a handful of bad words in it.
I want to say less than five.
Yeah, and the violence is not all that bloody.
The opening scene has a little disturbing imagery in it, but it's all in silhouette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and or off camera, or you know, where they move it, where you're not actually seeing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they dealt with that with great sensitivity. I know that the Marvel Comics movies tend to draw a lot of children. And so I'm glad that they were at least sensitive to the fact that parents are going to take their kids to see a comic book movie.
Yeah, you know, I don't
think regardless of rating.
I don't think I would be comfortable with anything below high school going to see this.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I guess I don't think that the maturity level of, say, middle school and below, and I'm just being very general here, is enough to separate the make-believe with the occult in this. Because in Doctor Strange, the purpose of the occult is to tell a story and to make a point. It's not pushing the occult as a viable career choice, so to speak.
Well, it kind of mixes it all together in this movie, too. It's not presenting any particular occult or any particular religion. It just seems to be a mishmash of different stuff.
A little like Kubo and the Two Strings was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe even more so than Kubo was. But yeah, it's. I don't think that the director or the writers or anybody was going for this is a true Eastern, mysticism.
I don't think they were pitching it as a vehicle to Eastern mysticism belief for anyone. Yeah,
right. Which I do think Kubo was. So I think that definitely is a difference. When we discuss this, of course, we do want to recommend that you go to PluggedIn.com to see their family-friendly review of the movie, but we also are going to put in the show notes a link to a really good article that someone else at Focus on the Family wrote regarding Doctor Strange. And it was a really good article. And then it had some links to some other really good articles in it, which you might discuss later on in the podcast, but we'll be putting links to those because there's actually been some really good stuff written about this movie that we want people to share. So make sure you go to our show notes at areyoujustwatching.com/64 to check out those links.
This movie seems to have drawn a lot more intellectual discussion than I think any of the other Marvel movies thus far, with the possible exception of Captain America Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But even that, the intellectual direction or the direction of the intellectual discussion for Doctor Strange certainly seems to be heavy in Christian circles,
mm-hmm.
Which is where I found that, most of it.
Well, like I said, I sat through the movie. I was seeing, you know, Christian allusions throughout just my first time sitting down to see the movie. So I can see why anybody who's gone to see it more than once or went in it with the idea that they were going to do in-depth analysis of what was going on in the story. Because of the spiritual aspects of this movie, it seems to set itself up for that kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and we're going to touch on that as we proceed in our podcast, but probably not to the depth that other people have done. So.
Yeah. We don't have the hours it would take to delve into this the way that they do.
Yes. And I know that there's a lot of women out there who are going to this movie just to see Benedict Cumberbatch. So... it is drawing a huge crowd.
Let's not stop just with women here. There are a lot of men who want to be Benedict Cumberbatch.
He's pretty amazing. The two women that I went to see the movie with, I think they pretty much were going for him. And one of them had already seen the movie once, and she thought it was so great, she was ready to go see it again. So that was kind of nice to have that input. But yeah, I think he's an amazing actor. I haven't followed him as closely as some of my friends have. I'm wondering if he would ever do a Bond, because he seems like he could do James Bond.
I was thinking Doctor Who, but...
Oh, you know, he might do a good Doctor Who, too. But they were saying
I would watch that.
He's hit almost all of the major franchises now. So yeah, definitely a good performance of all the cast members, but... He was the definite star of this movie.
Yep. No doubt about it. Well, let's go over the what we did and didn't like about it. And then we can get into the spoilers section.
Yeah.
Because most of what we have to discuss is going to be in the spoiler section.
Mm-hmm.
So just a heads up for our listeners, if you haven't seen it, but you think you might want to, I would encourage you to go see it. Because... the stuff we're going to be giving away in the spoiler section
might ruin the movie.
Yeah, really might ruin it. What did you like? What jumped out at you as being good and bad in Doctor Strange?
Well, it was a dizzyingly amazing special effects movie.
Oh yeah,
or I should say CGI more than special effects, but it really reminded me of Inception, but. To a greater degree. It's like Inception
on steroids.
Yeah, it was like Inception was the training ground for Doctor Strange. And part of that is it's very similar idea, you know, that Inception was going inside people's dreams and that you could twist the dreams in order to make things work the way you wanted them to work. And in this movie, it was more of you were shifting reality on a spiritual realm. And it kind of came across in very similar effects.
Yeah.
I kind of enjoyed the love story that was going on. It was subtle. Not definitely the point of the movie, but I appreciated that they threw that in. I think a lot of times with the Marvels, the love interest or the love story is kind of more of a side thing. And,
mm-hmm.
I think this worked well because it really played to who Doctor Strange was as a person. And I thought that was, I appreciated the way they did that.
Yeah. Rachel McAdams, the actress who played Dr. Palmer, Christine Palmer, did a really good job of portraying a level of unconditional agape love.
Mm-hmm. Her commitment to him, despite his arrogance and total...
it feels like arrogance isn't a strong enough word there. I mean, he was an egomaniac.
Yes. Yes. And he walked all over her and she bent over backwards. Not in a demeaning way for a woman to bend herself over backwards for a man. I think it was just that was the lengths that she was willing to go to because she loved him so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that whole character development there.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And her performance was was one of several very good performances.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I wouldn't say anything bad about Benedict Cumberbatch.
Get lynched if you do.
Open the door, find pitchforks and torches outside.
Yeah.
But he did an excellent job. Mm-hmm. He really made me dislike Dr. Stephen Strange at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't seem to be afraid to play the villain, and even the villain that you love to hate.
Yeah.
He seems to be very good at that.
And I want to call out the performance of the man who played Mordo.
Not as opposed to Mordor.
Exactly. No One we'll Ring in this one.
Yeah. We'll just get that out of the way because I've already stumbled on it multiple times.
I know I'm gonna absolutely murder his name, but it's
surprised you're gonna try.
Ejofor. And I have liked him in everything I've seen him in. I think the first movie that I noticed him in really was Serenity.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
he was the assassin in Serenity, and man, did he make that role come alive!
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he almost stole the movie.
He was in The Martian too. Uh-huh. He was the program director, wasn't he, in The Martian? Vincent Kapoor.
Yeah, was that him?
Yep.
Okay.
Or at least IMDb says it was.
Well, then IMDb is movie god, so.
Yeah. Who are we to question IMDb? Yes. I think he actually brings more depth to his roles than most actors out there. Mm-hmm. He seems to be able to find the subtleties of his character and really play on them to sort of take his character from a shell to from a straw man to a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the woman who played the Ancient One.
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what else I've seen her in.
That was an amazing performance, though. I mean, and her level of humor, it's not something you normally think of in that kind of role. That's the character, not necessarily the actress.
I know what I've seen her in now. She was the White Witch in Narnia.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Wow, I should have checked this before. I thought she did a very respectable job. I wasn't all that happy with her. I wasn't as pleased with her performance, I think, as you were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. Maybe it's just general bias on my point. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have anything to compare it to because, like I said, I went to this movie completely blind and with no expectations.
Yeah.
So I appreciated the way she played the character. And I thought it worked. And I'm glad they put some of those snippets of the beginning of the movie wasn't with Doctor Strange. It was actually with, you know, the bad guys and with her. And so that kind of gave us a warning as to where the movie was going from the beginning.
No, we didn't. Did we actually, in the opening scene, that fight, we didn't actually see her face, though, did we?
She dropped her hood and we saw her from the back.
Okay.
As she was walking down the street at the end. Yeah.
That's right. I even made a note in the dark about the scars on the back of her head. Because mm-hmm. I had this idea that maybe the scars worked into a pattern or something, but they didn't. I should write for Hollywood, I'll tell you what.
Yeah. Trying to list what I didn't like would be harder because I don't really recall anything standing out and saying, oh, that just went flat for me. I didn't follow that. So I would say I don't really have a list of, like I normally do, of things that bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really recall anything bothering me in this movie.
I think for me, the only thing that really bothered me is the redemption story for Stephen Strange. I feel like it was left open-ended, and it probably was intentionally.
All these Marvel Comics movies all run together, so I'm sure there's going to be another movie.
I felt like I was missing closure on the guy going from being a complete jerk to a defender of Earth from, you know, spiritual forces or multidimensional forces. But that's really the only complaint I have.
It did seem they kind of like rushed his training a little bit. He went from like apprentice to suddenly master and like...
And they explained it away.
Yeah.
Well, photographic memory. That's a little tropish, really.
Yeah.
Although it's probably part of his character, mm-hmm. you know, in the Marvel universe. So we can't really blame the director or the creative team for that. But still, I sort of wish that, you know, that's actually one thing I wrote in my notes is how long was the training?
Mm-hmm.
Because
you don't get a real feel for how much time has passed.
Yeah, I sort of got the impression when he came back that it was years.
Mm.
But I didn't notice anything in the film that actually provided that information. It would have been nice if they had
at least dropped hints 6 years later.
Yeah. Provided us something.
Yeah.
Just to say, you know, he's been in training this long.
Right. Yeah. And well,
all training has to have a musical montage, and there was no musical montage in this film. So I'm a little heartbroken about that.
Yeah. Well, he didn't really train. He read. So.
And read.
Yeah. So, well, I think from this point on, we probably should warn of spoilers and move on to some more in-depth discussions about themes we saw in the movie. Now, I will say this right off the bat, that there's no way in the amount of time that we have to record this episode, there's no way we can hit on everything that was in this movie.
Yeah.
This is definitely one that probably would have worked better as a DVD where we could pick it apart and do two episodes, but we're not going to do that. We're just going to hit the highlights. Mm-hmm. And we really, really, really want you guys to show up on Facebook and hit the parts we miss, because there's going to be a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's go for it.
let's jump into the spoilers section.
Yes.
Okay, so what I think we should do is I think we should focus our discussion on three of the characters who are essentially spiritual warriors in this. Dr. Stephen Strange, Catechus, the villain, and Mordo, the... boy, what would you call him?
I don't know. You're the one that's leading this discussion.
He's a co-pupil. He's a peer of Dr. Strange. Though he had been there, again, I got the idea significantly longer.
I think he's kind of more like a mentor, because he'd already, he was actually in some scenes teaching Dr. Strange.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's sort of like in, have you ever taken any martial arts?
Mm-mm.
In martial arts classes, the sensei will often tap the higher ranked students to take the newer students and show them the basics. It's an important part of martial art training. Mm-hmm. And I got the impression that's what was happening here.
You always learn something better when you teach it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like Kung Fu Panda 3. the last thing Po has to master is teaching.
Yeah.
We didn't do that movie, did we? No, we didn't. Okay. So Dr. Strange is the... titular character, so let's jump into him real quick.
Okay.
As we had discussed earlier, Dr. Strange at the beginning of the movie is a complete and utter egomaniacal jerk.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, everything he does is about promoting his own glory.
Mm-hmm.
He was choosing his cases about whether or not they would be challenging for him and whether or not they successful conclusion, because that's all he had, a successful conclusion would, increase his fame.
Right.
So,
and he would turn down cases that he didn't feel like he could complete properly. He didn't want any failures on his record.
Yeah.
So if there was a chance for failure, he wouldn't do it.
One of the cases actually plays back into the movie with what I would call a cameo role by Benjamin Bratt, where Benjamin Bratt played a construction worker who was had his spine completely severed and Strange turned down the surgery on it because he didn't think it was – he thought it was a lost cause.
Mm-hmm.
And that it doesn't come back to haunt him in the film, but it does come back to inform him, which I thought was a nice way to do this. And the way it plays into the second end credits scene is particularly interesting to me.
Right.
So when Strange is very badly injured, he essentially has to have his hands rebuilt. And by everything discussed in the movie, it's a spectacular job they did, but he will never, ever be a surgeon again.
And he was actually not happy with it. He's like, they were like, nobody could have done better. And he's like, I could have, you know, it was just kind of like that. He thought they'd ruined him.
When he said that, I was thinking, wait a minute, isn't this guy a neurosurgeon?
It was his nerves and the nerves into his hands that were damaged. That's why they shook so bad.
I always thought that neurosurgeons specialized in essentially brain surgery, but I guess the entire nervous system would fall under their purview, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
Yeah. Stephen Strange just falls into complete, actually slowly falls into madness trying to find a solution to get his hands back because his world is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like there was an idolatry of fame and control here for Stephen Strange.
Yeah. And, you know, I think part of it was his atheistic worldview. And that's actually what comes under attack when he meets the Ancient One. It's interesting because everything to him is in the now and it's material and it's natural. He doesn't have anything to go beyond. So it definitely would make sense that when he's built his whole life around what he can do with his hands and then he loses his hands, that his life is broken because that's all there is. He has no other level of understanding, no other level of goals. Everything is materialistic and in the here and now. And I think that to be honest, that shows kind of a fault in that worldview that they're,
yep.
Where we can so easily break ourselves because we're dependent on the things in the now and the materialistic because we have no other level of understanding.
Yeah. It's like, one of the most common idolatries that, Christians call out is the idolatry of money. And it's so easy to find yourself suddenly no longer making that enormous sum that you were making or in possession of the material goods that you used to have.
Mm-hmm.
The idols of mankind are all very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mystery to me how more people don't reach out to the permanent, the permanence of God, the eternality of God and his character and essence.
It's interesting because I had a discussion fairly recently with an atheist. And one of the things that she stated to me that kind of gave me a different perspective on her was that she said that she felt that it would make her weak to believe in religion, that she was making herself a stronger person by striving to be better and to ascend and be, you know, to do good deeds and to ascend in some level of form. And what puzzled me about that is that her understanding of it was that she could make herself better, but where was the goal? I mean, what standard was she defining what being better or what being good was? Because when it's a subjective standard, then you don't have a real goal to be reaching for, number one. And number two, if you do have a goal, you either set it too low and you make it too easy, or you set it too high and make yourself depressed because you can't ever attain it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of, when in the discussion, I kind of told her my viewpoint was that when, as Christians, we have, we don't have the responsibility to make ourselves as good as God because we can't do it. We start with the assumption it's impossible, and we let God reach down to us instead. And that may seem like an easy crutch, but it's actually hard because our mentality is to be exactly what she says that she wants to be, to perform and make ourselves better. That's the human nature. We want to be in control of our lives. We want to be the kings of our lives. And to hand that, surrender that over to someone else is a lot of work. And I think it that perhaps she didn't understand how much, how hard it is to let go of self.
Yeah.
And how much of a sacrifice that is.
I think the drive to be stronger and be a better person that that she is expressing, I think it has it certainly has roots in God. Romans 2:14-16 says, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law unto themselves, even though they do not have the law.
Mm-hmm.
They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Jesus Christ."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was interesting because in that discussion, we're going a little bit off topic. I think it fits with Dr. Strange. In that discussion, she says, "It might surprise you to know that I'm a very spiritual person." And I was like, no, actually, it doesn't surprise me at all, because God created us in his image. We were all spiritual beings. And it only makes sense that even when we try to deny the spiritual realm, which is basically what atheists do, it's not materialistic, it's not natural, they can't prove it exists, so therefore they deny that it exists. When you try to deny that, there's a part inside of you that knows you're not, that it knows that it's true. It may not be able, something that you can, you know, scientifically prove, but you know in your heart, because that's a part of God that's in you, that the spiritual realm is there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's willful ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Intellectual dishonesty.
Yeah, exactly. and you know, the fact that Strange has to be introduced to this world of this world beyond the one he understands is a very big part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting how the Ancient One sort of tied it back into the idea that some people would call it magic, some people would call it spells, but it's just a manipulation of energy. And that reminded me of that Arthur C. Clarke quote that sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That actually ties back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe to a line that was in one of, I think, the original Thor movie, where Thor was talking to Natalie Portman's characters about how it seems like magic, but it's really science.
That was one of the things that fascinated me about the Thor movie when it came out, was that in our mythology, Thor is a god, but what they show him to be in the Marvel Universe is a alien from another dimension. And so he has more power because in his dimension, that's the way, you know, people are. And it just, they took away that spiritual aspect of gods and put it into a different hierarchy of beings. And, but yet in this movie, where they don't necessarily go with gods as a terminology, you kind of get the feel that there is something of a godly struggle going on.
Yeah.
And that's where the spiritual warfare aspect comes in. And they even say in the movie that there's this division, because they say the heroes protect the physical world and the sorcerers protect the spiritual world.
I was interested in your thoughts on when throughout the entire movie, or at least the first three quarters of the movie, Strange is focused on restoring his hands. how do you think that the fact that he, at the end, made the conscious decision to not fix his hands, how do you think that plays into the overall presentation or theme of the movie?
There was a line where he was talking to Dr. Palmer near the end, and where he said, you told me that you had said to me that losing my hands didn't have to be an end. It could be a beginning, and that I should learn how to save lives a different way. That's a paraphrase because I didn't get the whole quote.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
But I think that that ties into what you're asking, because that was near the end of the movie. That was where he had had discovered a truth that she had told him from the beginning, but he wasn't ready to hear it before. And when he got to the end of that journey through defending the spiritual realm and whatever, and this was actually, I think that quote actually came before he faced down in the final battle. But
Dumatu,
yeah,
or Dumatu or whatever his name
yeah,
is.
Yeah, right. Before he faced down this dark lord of whatever this dark dimension was, he was already getting there, and that was, he was acknowledging to her, you were right, that losing my hands was not the end, that I could save lives a different way. That was his acknowledgement to her. And so I think that that's what he got out of what the Ancient One told him there at the end of her life. And, mm-hmm. and that it was what he took into that final battle, that he had learned a different way to save lives. And before, to him, the saving the lives was not the important thing, but he had grown as a character to the point where it didn't matter how he did it. It was only that lives were saved.
Yeah, it's he actually had an argument with Mordo about whether or not the zealots of Calicus should be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that I saw it, I was thinking that he was holding fast to the Hippocratic Oath. He even first says that, you know, first do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
But he really does seem to embrace that. And I didn't think of this until you responded to my question, but regarding the hands,
mm-hmm.
There's this quote, there's this short conversation between Mordo and the Ancient One, where he says, Mordo says, I wanted to learn to defeat my enemies. I learned how to defeat my demons. And the Ancient One says, we never lose our demons. We only learn to live above them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty early on maybe halfway through the movie, but it never occurred to me that that would be foreshadowing the fact that Strange never chooses to never repair his hands. Mm-hmm. He raises himself to where their injury doesn't really impact him.
Well, and I think that there was a discussion there between someone, and I can't remember now where it was, but about the Pangborn, the Benjamin Pratt character, who had gotten only so far as to make himself able to walk again, to use his sorcery to make his body whole, or to hold his body whole. He didn't necessarily repair his body. He was just using sorcery to be able to walk and use his body like it was healed.
And yeah, he was powering it through that power.
Through that power. And it was like almost like, and I can't remember who the discussion was, but it seemed like the Ancient One was involved. But there was some disappointment there that he had chosen to use that power selfishly instead of move beyond that physical need and join their ranks instead of just healing himself. And it seemed to me that that was in the movie somewhere, but I couldn't tell you exactly where it was. I have to go see the movie again. Maybe our listeners can help us with that.
Yeah. When Strange talked to Brat's character,
mm-hmm.
At the basketball court, Brat's character said, I should really look up what his name was. Pangborn said that more was offered, but he didn't have the strength to pursue it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the sense of disappointment from the Ancient One. Now I really wish I could.
And can't remember whether it was even Mordo that had brought him up. I just remember at some point he was under discussion with other characters in the movie, and there was a sense of disappointment there that he had chosen to not continue further and to take it beyond this, you know, this very selfish way of using his power. And I think that that Doctor Strange, because of his series of adventures that he got blown into, to be honest, where he got blown into New York City by himself to try and protect that section of the shield. He went into that unprepared, but he rose to the challenge and he grew as a character because of that. And I think that that is really what this movie was about, was his growth as a character. It wasn't that he wasn't the same person at the end as he was at the beginning.
You actually bring up an interesting point here, because one of the things I noticed is that even though he grew as a character, his understanding and his interaction with the world grew. At the end, he was still his personality hasn't really changed. He's still arrogant. Still comes across as arrogant. And I think there's a, this may be a little shallow, but I think there's a bit of a parallel there to accepting Christ. When you accept Christ, there's not this magic
transformation.
You become a nice person. Exactly. Yeah. You could be a complete jerk when you accept Christ, and there's still a lot of work that goes into the process of sanctification. There's a lot of growth. It's just like, you know, the stages of childhood, from infant to baby to toddler to child. And I appreciate that in Doctor Strange, they did not make his transformation into mystical saint.
Yeah, he didn't become a Buddha.
Complete. Yeah, exactly.
But you know what? I don't think that that was the point of the training that he was undergoing, was to make him a good person. I think the point of the training that they were putting him through was to make him a warrior in the spiritual realm. And warriors are not always nice people. And yeah. I think that they did shape him into what they needed him to be. And he allowed himself, he surrendered himself. And that was actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about briefly, was, you know, that whole, the first step that he had to do, what Mordo told him to do when he first took him to introduce him to the Ancient One, was that he had to forget everything you think you know. And that's that whole level of arrogance that he was at, where he thought he knew everything, and he had to be knocked way down on that pedestal.
That's for sure.
And that's a humbling.
He was knocked through the pedestal.
He was knocked through. Yeah, that was a humbling experience. And I think that that's where we all have to be. We have to come to God on our knees. We can't come to God as an equal and say, hey, you know, I think you can do some really great things in my life, so I'm going to invite you in to do some stuff, and we're going to be on equal terms here. That's not the way salvation works. We have to forget everything we think we know, and realize that God knows everything, and what we do know is so infinitesimally small compared to what he knows, that we have no place to stand before him. We can only come groveling on our knees.
Yeah, most of what we know is completely wrong.
Yeah.
We just have to come to realization of that wrongness.
Right, right. And I that was one of the first things that jumped out in the movie at me as being a very biblical thing. And I couldn't actually give you a verse for it, because I think that it kind of is woven through all of the New Testament, that whole philosophy of letting go of who you are and letting God be. And part of that is, you know, acknowledging that you are nothing in front of him. And that's what Dr. Strange had a hard time with that, because
boy, did he.
And even after he went through this amazingly humbling experience with the Ancient One, she throws him out. He had to actually sit on the doorstep and beg
for hours
for them to let him back in. And that was, he had to be humbled. He had to be brought all the way down in order for him to get admittance.
Good point. Yeah.
And that brings into, you know, the whole realm of sacrifice and surrender, because there was a line, another line that really jumped out at me. There were several in this movie, but the Ancient One told him at one point, your intellect has taken you far in life. It can take you no further. Surrender. And when she made that comment about surrendering, it was just that whole jumping from, you start out knowing nothing and you, admitting how little you know, really, and then you have to surrender yourself. And that is repeated quite often in a lot of Paul's writings, like in Romans 6, where he goes in talking about how we are crucified with Christ and we put our flesh to death so that we can live in Christ. And so there's we're never actually told to surrender, but everything, the way it's put together through a lot of Paul's imagery, is that's essentially what he's telling you to do, is to lay your life down and surrender yourself so that God can dwell within you and transform you. And I know that that's not exactly what the Ancient One was telling him to do. He was supposed to surrender himself to the power, which is very dangerous, actually, especially when you're talking about it from occult terms. You never know what's going to take control of you when you just surrender without surrendering to a particular spiritual being. You can get yourself in big trouble. But that was essentially a very Christian imagery there of surrendering yourself.
So Dr. Strange is the, he's the main, he becomes the main spiritual warrior of the film. But they're, and putting aside the Ancient One, who is really the grand mentor of them all, I want to talk about the other two spiritual warriors. First, let's talk about Caecilius. There we go. He is like many Marvel villains. Caecilius believes that he is pursuing, if not good, then the betterment of mankind. He doesn't come across in the film as being strictly evil. I really got the impression that he was maybe self-deceived or intentionally deceived.
Seduced.
I don't know.
In fact, Mordo's
seduced is excellent. Yeah.
Mordo actually tells Dr. Strange that he was seduced by a false doctrine. That was another line that jumped at him. Cause that just screams scripture as well. In fact, I wrote down in our show outline, I wrote down in Ephesians 4, starting in verse 11, it says, and he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every word of doctrine, by human cunning, by craftiness and deceitful schemes. So this is something as Christians that we are all prone to if we are not properly unified in message, I guess I should say. We're very prone to following after every wind of doctrine that will blow us this way and that. We see that a lot in the Western church today. There is a ton of false teaching going on in evangelicalism, in our culture. And I suspect it's probably in multiple cultures. It's not just in Western, but we televise a lot of our Christianity and it comes across where you can see it. And I think that that's what has happened in Doctor Strange, is that there were these other philosophies that Caecilius got pulled away from the track that he was on with the Ancient One by listening. He was seduced by false doctrines that pulled him away from. And that's kind of interesting when you think about it, because his character, when we see him at the very beginning of the movie, he's after a particular ritual. And when the Ancient One sees what ritual he rips out of this book, she tells him that this ritual will bring you only sorrow. And she's warning him that he's going down a path that will not give him what he thinks it will give him.
And she knows what she's talking about, too.
Yeah, because she's used the ritual, we find
exactly.
out.
Exactly. I get the impression that Caecilius has... he has realized that the Ancient One is drawing from the power of Dormammu,
mm-hmm.
to sustain herself, and really believes that power. He sees what the Ancient One is doing with it, and he believes that power is the answer to humanity's woe, which is death. Humans must die, and it seems like Caecilius is all about fixing that.
Mm-hmm.
The Ancient One, yeah.
He fixes it the wrong way. His desire is to have a physical eternal life.
But that's not what eternal life is about.
No.
Otherwise, The Mummy would be a completely different movie.
Yeah.
Completely.
Whenever Caecilius was speaking in the movie, that was when a lot of lines jumped out at me. And it really clued me into the fact that there was a right and wrong answer that was fighting between Caecilius and the Ancient One. And mm-hmm. for example, there was one scene where he's talking about death being an insult. And that is actually scriptural. I mean, we can pick out actual verses in the Bible where it talks about death being the enemy. That's not the way God created the world to be, where death and disease and all of these things that were inflicted on his creation by sin. Caecilius was actually right from a biblical standpoint that death is an insult. It's not supposed to happen that way.
Yep. Death is wrong.
Death is wrong. There's something twisted and just has no place in God's creation. And that comes from, I'm going to read it from 1 Corinthians 15:20-26. It says, but in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. But even in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ, then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom of God to the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death. So Christ conquers death. With what he did on the cross, he conquered death. He was resurrected. He put death in its place. It was the final enemy. But it is a victory over death that we will not see until we die the first death, or until he comes again and renews the heavens and the earth.
When the perishable puts on the imperishable, the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting?
And you have to... Yeah, you have to keep going. The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what Caecilius seems to be seeing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Boy, I didn't draw that link until this discussion. That's very good, profound insight.
Yeah, that's also in 1 Corinthians 15, and that those verses were 53 through 56. Oh, 57. So yeah, it's just that death has this a lot of discussion, especially in the New Testament, where we're talking about death as something that we have to have victory over. And that is what Caecilius is trying to do. He actually has something of a biblical perspective. It's just he's given himself to the wrong Lord. It's like instead of following after Christ, he's following after Satan, because you really get the feel that this... Dormandu, or whatever his name is, is the Satan in this realm.
It's, you know, it's sort of like when my car breaks down and I know it's the ignition system, but I don't have a clue how to fix it. And what Caecilius is doing is he's sort of like taking it all apart, and he's the fix will come as we put it back together.
And that's kind of contrasted with the discussion that Dr. Strange has with the Ancient One, when she's busy dying, and she decides to take a moment.
She's taking it pretty well.
Yeah,
though.
I mean, she takes a moment to stand and watch it snow, and it's interesting because she has a completely different standpoint on it. She says, "Death is what gives life meaning. To know your days are numbered and your time is short. You'd think after all this time I'd be ready, but look at me stretching one moment out into a thousand just so I can watch the snow." So she has this, like, this feeling of completion, like she has stretched her life way beyond what it was supposed to be, but she takes meaning in the fact that her days were still numbered, that she saw a future in which she would cease to be. And so to me, it was very strange that it seemed like the bad guy was taking the biblical point of view in this movie.
I like that. I like the idea that they see a problem and they try to fix it, but the bad guy portion comes in how they apply their fix.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. He turned to the wrong way with it. And we can find, I think that's one of the reasons why I wonder how the world could not be Christian, because when you see death from a atheistic point of view, it just ends. It's like, it's just, that's it. And how can there be any hope when you die without a hope beyond that? And when you lose a loved one, and what do you think, that they just, you just buried them and that's the end and you'll never see them again? And there's no hope in that. And I don't even know that the Ancient One was saying that that was a definite end for her, that she wasn't moving on to something else, that they didn't really tackle that. But I kind of get where she's saying, in that there is hope in knowing that you have a certain period of time in which to live your life. And so there's truth in what she said, too, as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily biblical truth, but there's truth there.
And you know, the irony of Caedicus becoming the villain is that if the Ancient One had been more open, I guess, about how she was the Ancient One, I mean, what she had to do, if she hadn't drawn the line so boldly against working with the, not the powers of darkness per se, but powers of destruction, I guess. I'm not sure how you would classify Dormammu. But if she hadn't drawn the line so boldly, neither of the two antagonists, the one in this movie and the one to come, neither of them would have had any fuel for their fire, because Caedicus his fuel is all about using Dormammu's power to provide the eternity that he believes all mankind seeks, and Mordo is the hard line Pharisee of the group, where he sees what the Ancient One, when he learns what the Ancient One has done, he doesn't step back and he evaluate it.
He doesn't evaluate his own view. He reevaluates her.
Exactly.
Her. And, yeah.
And he finds her wanting.
Mm-hmm.
So he becomes judge, jury, and executioner.
Right.
Which is a good leap into the third spiritual warrior, which is Mordo. So Mordo is devout. He is very, very devout, and he believes wholeheartedly in the rules as they're laid down. And I really appreciate what they did with his character, because it happens. Not only is it pictured so vividly in the Bible with the interactions with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but it happens in our lives so often, where people start to place the rules themselves, the commandments, above the commander.
Right. Legalism.
Yeah.
Where the law becomes this instrument of punishment, I guess, that we wield against each other. and we cannot, we lose our flexibility. And I'm not saying compromise, I'm saying our flexibility. And Christ was very much against that. We saw him standing up to the Pharisees, the religious rulers of his day, you know, really bringing them to task about the many things that they were doing wrong in the way they were using the law. And he basically internalized it all. It's instead of just doing all of these things, you have to internalize it and make it a part of your heart.
Yeah.
So that you see the world differently, you just don't behave differently.
Yeah, Mordo, really, he's all about justice and has completely left the mercy behind.
Yeah, his comment was, we do not tamper with natural law, we defend it. And so he doesn't see the natural law as something that you can twist or manipulate or use. It's something that you simply defend. And mm-hmm. and both the Ancient One and Dr. Strange, especially the way he rescues the world at the end, is a manipulation and a twisting of the natural law. And
yeah.
That's why it puts him at odds with Mordo at the end.
And Mordo goes through this seeming transformation in that final scene, and then in the final scene of the movie proper, and then that transformation is seen in its fruition in the second credit scene.
Well, yeah, he actually says, we did this all by violating the natural law. And mm-hmm. and then he makes I think it's actually some of the last lines in the actual movie before you get to the like the little teaser scenes. But he says, you still think there will be no consequences. The bill comes due always, always. Yeah. So he's got a very hardline way of looking at it. And he's not able to flex himself out of that view. And what I find really interesting, and I want to bring up one of the articles that you and I were actually just read before we got on to record, was this article that we're going to link in the show notes. Doctor Strange is the Most Religious Superhero Movie Ever by Paul Essay.
Mm.
And I don't want to steal his thunder because I want you to go read his article. But one of the things he brings up near the end of his article is that what God did in bringing Christ to Earth and having him crucified and raised again to defeat death was a twisting of the laws, the natural laws that he created. I'm not saying that God doesn't have the ability to flex his own laws. He made them, so he can do whatever he wants. That's what miracles are. But I thought that was a very interesting insight into how God breaks his own rules all the time. And he's capable of doing that. And we can't be this whole hardcore. Well, obviously, we have to follow the commandments he gave us. We don't want to break his rules. He's the only one that can do that. But we have to be flexible and merciful in how we apply that.
So the miracles in the Bible are definitely an example of God breaking the rules as we understand them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
it's only as we understand them. Our limited knowledge of the laws that he created, it seems like he's breaking them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's actually breaking them, because it's only within our limited understanding. And we've already established that what we know is a very tiny piece of what God knows.
Yeah. And just like Stephen Strange and the spiritual defense of the earth.
Right.
Of the world, of the multiverses, of
whatever it is,
the omniverse, or I was caught of the three. My wife, son, and I all saw Doctor Strange together, and I think I was the first one to pick up that the Eye of Agamotto actually was housing the Time Infinity Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a kick out of the fact that that the sole purpose of the Time Infinity Stone is to bend the rules of time. So Mordo was – he was a lost cause as soon as you realized that the Eye of Agamotto was the Time Infinity Stone, because his laws are broken right in that eye. So I am curious if the eye had been used very much before that.
Yeah, that's kind of weird because, you know, they made such a big deal about the other Infinity Stone with the other Marvel Comics movies coming to Earth, and – and then everybody fighting over it. And it'd be kind of weird to think that they had one sitting in the temple in Hong Kong. Was it Hong Kong? All this time, you know.
Well, the doors, the sanctum was in Kathmandu, and then the doors led to the three, or not the sanctum,
okay.
But the,
I guess it was Kathmandu.
The temple was
then.
In Kathmandu, and there were doors that led to the three sanctums, New York, okay. Hong Kong, and London?
Yeah, London, yeah. That created the shield. The three, they needed all of those locations to create the shield to cover the entire earth and protect it.
Yep.
And the shield had to come down before the Dark Lord could pull his dimension in, create a portal into his dimension and yank everything out of whack. Which, you know, surprisingly, it's interesting because this movie had some destruction in it, but in the end it was all put back. For the mm-hmm. most part, it was all put back because he turned time back on itself and undid what was done. And of all of the Marvel Comics movies so far, I would say it has the lowest amount of destruction.
I think I read a quote that somebody said it's nice to see it's nice to see the buildings coming back together for once in a Marvel film.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I just started last night. I don't know whether you have Netflix, don't you?
Yes.
Have you watched the Netflix Daredevil original?
Oh. I am a big fan of the Daredevil series.
Okay, I have just
both seasons so far.
I have just started it, so I'm only like five episodes in. But one of the things that I took note of was that the whole rebuilding of Hell's Kitchen is based on the original Avengers movie, where they pretty much destroy New York City. And it took me a little while to catch on to that, what they were doing, and I was like, "There's that tie-in, you know that." Every time the mm-hmm. Avengers get out there and do something, there's a whole lot of damage.
Yeah.
But this movie didn't have it.
Yeah, nobody even remembers the damage that happens in this one because mm-hmm. the time rolls back.
Right.
With these three spiritual warriors, it really does turn out to be... Strange is really the centrist in the group. I mean, Mordo is the hardline conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And Caedicus really is...
Caecilius,
thank you.
you change it every time you say it.
How many different variations of his name can I come up with? Caecilius really is the guy... He's the one who's passionate about providing the solution to everybody who may not even acknowledge the problem.
Right.
So Dr. Stephen Strange really is sort of in the middle there. He's willing to bend the rules, but will abide by them in most cases type of thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, you put a verse here in our show notes that we haven't actually discussed, and I think it really applies very well to this movie. It's Ephesians 6:12, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." And for those of those in our culture who deny the spiritual, I think that a lot of times they have to turn a blind eye because you may not be able to see into the spiritual realm, but you can definitely, it's like a wind. You can see where it affects the real world.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that trying to deny that there is a spiritual realm is really, like we said before, intellectual dishonesty. You have to really try hard not to see it.
Yeah, it's clear that... that there are so many people out there who see it. I mean, it even shows up in Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
In Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in our philosophy.
Yeah.
It really is. I would be so uncomfortable living a life where I believed that what I perceived was all there was to perceive.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever read Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis?
Yes. Yes.
I love it. For our listeners, Screwtape Letters, if you haven't read them, is a series of letters between I want to call them lesser demons, Wormwood and Screwtape. Is Wormwood the agent who's with the human?
I don't remember. It's been a very long time since I've read them.
One of them is assigned to be the pilot of a human to try and steer him the wrong way. And the other one is lesser demon's uncle. And the Screwtape Letters is a series of correspondences between the two on how
to lead a person astray.
Yeah, and how to fight the dastardly influences of faith. The way that speaks to the spiritual realm, I don't think that C.S. Lewis meant it to be a literal interpretation of the spiritual realm, but it certainly does speak to the battle between the forces of God and the forces of the Prince of Lies. Mm-hmm. And even though the war is already won, that God is...
it's one of his tools.
Christ specifically is victor.
It's one of the, yeah. It's one of his tools to make us deny the fact that there is a spiritual war going on. So when people put their foot down and say there is no spiritual realm, you're just falling prey to a lie. And this is an interesting tie-in because we did Kubo recently, and this verse is actually a continuation coming out of the the putting on the whole armor of God concept. And so this is how we arm ourselves, because there is a spiritual war. It's not because of a physical war. We are not physical soldiers for Christ, other than we are spreading the gospel in sometimes places where that doesn't want to hear it. We can put our lives at risk for that, but it's more of a need to protect ourselves in the spiritual war that we requires us to don the armor that God has given us.
Yeah. Lewis even mentions in the book, don't let him consider the spiritual life, the afterlife. Don't let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as they start thinking about it, you've lost.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to wrap this discussion up. There, like I said at the beginning of all of this, there's so much more in this movie. I have highlighted in my notes a whole bunch of things about fear of death and humanity longing for eternity. Let's see. There was a line in there, see in part, but not the whole, which made me think of a specific, it's actually a verse out of a very popular hymn, but it comes from scripture about being able to not see God, that we're like looking at God and spiritual things through a veil. But when we reach the end, when we cross over to that other side, we'll see everything as in whole, and it'll be like this brilliant moment of enlightenment that will just blow our minds.
Yeah.
And so there's these little phrases that really popped out to me throughout the movie, and I'm hoping that I wasn't the only one that caught some of these, and that there were some of our listeners may have caught some that I didn't catch, and that we can start some discussions, because there's so much more in this movie. So much more.
Well, we should definitely have plenty to talk about in the Facebook section. So let's jump in there and start the conversation.
Sure, definitely. And you can also comment on the show notes, which will, again, be at areyoujustwatching.com/64. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at 903-231-2221. Email us at feedback@areyoujustwatching.com. And Tim and I are both on Twitter. I'm Twitter at Eve Franklin.
I'm at RENCHEPLE.
Really, that's, I think, it for this episode.
Real quick, can I do a shout out to the great feedback that we got recently from, it was Nash, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, it's really appreciated his feedback, and want to encourage people to follow his lead.
Yes.
And provide feedback, good and bad.
Yes.
We take it all straight to heart, and we will work we'll work and we'll reply. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The feedback is important. It helps us know that you're out there. And to be honest, it's really surprising to me how diverse our audience is. And I don't know that until I hear from you folks. When you email us, that really gives me an idea who's out there. And just fascinating to realize how wide a diversity there is in our audience. And we have an atheist who has claimed to listen to us, which really surprised me. And it's just, I sometimes feel like I'm preaching to the choir when I'm talking to this mic, but we'd love to.
Turns out we're not.
Yeah, we'd love to get to know more of you. So please do send us emails. Thank you so much for listening to Are You Just Watching? I'm E. Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And don't just watch.
Are You Just Watching is a proud member of the Noodle Mix Network at noodle.mx. Our opening vocal talent was thanks to Mariah. The theme song is used courtesy of Answers in Genesis. For more great podcasts like this one, visit the Noodle Mix Network at noodle.mx. That's noodle.mx.